Thank you very much. So who am I handing over to?
I can just kick it off.
Do you have it? Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Sue, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to the May board meeting. As you will see from Agenda Paper 12, we have a few different topics to cover in today's session. So without taking up any more of your time, let me hand over to Wei Shun, who will walk us through Agenda Paper 12A.
Thank you. I will now discuss Agenda Paper 12A. At its April meeting, the Interpretations Committee decided to finalize an agenda decision about the periods of service to which an entity attributes benefit for a particular defined benefit plan. Today, we would like to ask the board whether it objects to that agenda decision. Appendix A includes a copy of the agenda decision approved by the committee. Paragraphs 6 to 9 summarize comments received on the tentative agenda decision and the committee's April discussion. Before going on to ask the board whether it objects to the agenda decision, I want to highlight paragraph 13. Some respondents to the tentative agenda decision said paragraphs 70 to 74 of IAS 19 are not always clear about the principles to apply when attributing benefit to periods of service. While voting to finalize the agenda decision, the committee suggested reporting this feedback to the board. The question for the board is in paragraph 12 of the paper.
Okay, does anybody want to comment? Tada.
Thank you, Sue. Sorry, taking time for unmuting myself. Thank you, staff, for preparing the agenda paper. I do not object to the committee's decision and conclusion. I just have one question in relation to what you just comment on paragraph 13. When you report to the board the comment that some respondents made about the principles in paragraph 70 to 74, that they may not always be clear, whether this is a suggestion that it should be carried out an investigation, and if this is the case in the future, propose a narrow scope amendment. What exactly the report to the board action means?
Maybe I can respond to that, Tatu. Yeah. I think in this case, by the way, there are often when we have discussions at the Interpretations Committee where something will come up often as part of comment letters where the committee just feel it is worth the board sort of knowing about it. And sometimes there's different things there. Sometimes in reporting that information to the board, the committee might go on to say, and I think the board should, you know, have a look at it as part of its agenda consultation or as part of the PIO or on a particular topic. I think in this case, it is very much that it was just reporting this information to the board, but there wasn't any anticipated or expected action to be taken. And maybe if I just give you slightly more flavor around sort of what the comments that were made were, in a sense, because you might, I think if you read that comment, you might say, but why were they then happy to maybe finalize the agenda decision if there was still some commentary or some maybe, you know, concern or uncertainty about the principles in that part of IS 19. So I think just to explain, Tadu, I think that what the committee concluded through its discussions was that the principles and requirements in those paragraphs do provide an adequate basis for this particular fact pattern that was submitted to the committee. So they obviously felt comfortable and voted to finalize the agenda decision on the basis that paragraph 70 to 74 provided an adequate basis for this particular fact pattern, you know, to reach the conclusions that it did in the agenda decision. However, what came up, I think in some of the comment letters, was just if there were some other fact patterns, they weren't always sure whether, you know, I say 70 to 74, you know, would always have all the answers, let's say. So I think maybe to conclude on your question, I think there's no expected action on the part of the board on this, but it was just something the committee thought they want the board members to be aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Mary?
Thanks, Sue, and thanks, Wei Shun. Again, like Tadeo, I do not object to the final agenda decision, so let's get that clear. My comments are incremental to that. and they kind of, one from an overall process perspective, like kind of like today's comments, thinking as I do in a rather old-fashioned paper-based environment, I feel like we should have, in effect, a file folder for each standard so that as issues come up, we put them in there if we're not planning to address them immediately. So at a point in time when we're looking at either is there critical mass or are we opening up a standard for some other reason, we should pick up these other issues that have been raised along the way. And I think that this comment probably falls into that category of things that we put in the file folder, the comment from the interpretation committee members. So that's one thing. And the second thing, and it goes back, Petrina, a bit to what you were saying, this agenda decision is appropriately very specific to its fact pattern. And it was, for example, important to the committee that the requirement of the plan was for continuous years of service. Some of the letters that the interpretation committee received on the tentative agenda decision raised questions about what if in practice some of the terms were applied less strictly, and so they waived certain of the requirements. And the committee said, no, what we're doing is answering the fact pattern as it was presented. That, and I'm just emphasizing this because we all have to remember that IS 19 requires you to account for constructive obligations as well as planned terms. And that is relevant, but the agenda decision, again, appropriately, is not trying to go into those further complications or assessment of judgments. It's pointing to both requirements and an example in the interpretation that the committee decided, and I think they're right, apply in the fact pattern submitted. But it isn't just a blanket follow the form kind of answer. It's assuming these terms are substantive.
Thanks, Mary. Françoise?
Thank you. Well, I came to this meeting ready to approve the agenda decision, but this discussion leads me to an additional question, in fact. My understanding is that the premise to the issuance of an agenda decision is that, of course, I mean, it's meant to foster convergence in practice, but I think the interpretation committee issues those agenda decisions when the issue is assessed as having widespread relevance. Is that limitation to a particular fact pattern compatible with the assessment of the widespread relevance? Or are we just, in fact, addressing one specific situation and, in fact, similar but not quite the same situation would still remain unclear in how they should be handled?
And we'll hand back to the staff, but my recollection just as a prompt was, Javid and Petrina in particular, that there was some discussion, Françoise, about how narrow the fact pattern was, and I think ultimately it was important that we had the very specific fact pattern set out in the agenda decision. But there was a sort of core idea in the agenda decision that was really what the focus was. Javid's nodding, which is good, but maybe could you answer Françoise's question more in a more technical way than I just did?
Yeah, no, I can take a stab, and Petrina, you can come in. So I think, Sue, you're absolutely correct. Well, I think when the committee looked at this question, yes, it came from a particular jurisdiction for a particular fact pattern. But as we did outreach, we found out, like, some elements of the fact pattern, like especially what Mary highlighted about the continuous years of service, was quite common in different plans as well. And I think what the committee felt as they discussed this was it was quite important to draw out the principles that applied when you have this sort of a fact pattern with continuous years of service, and that itself could be more widely applicable. But then, like Mary and others have said, like, you would have to look very closely at the relevant facts and circumstances of each plan to determine the accounting. But at least the committee felt it was helpful to draw out the principles that underpin some of the facts surrounding this plan. Petrina, I'm not sure if you want to add anything to that.
No, I think you've covered, I'll only add to say, I think that in as well, Francois, if it helps in some of the comment letters and feedback, it's almost like people were suggesting we would get even more specific and add on various other, I'll call them bells and whistles in a sense, but almost suggesting getting down to adding even more terms and conditions that might make it even more specific in a sense, because they had come across plans that had some of these facts and circumstances, but also extra. And I think that where we ended up in this, to have something where the explanation, of course, it is very much linked to the fact pattern that's described. However, we think it's not so specific that it would only, for example, provide information in the context of one plan.
Okay, thank you. With that, can we vote on the question in question 12? Could I see if any board members object to the committee's conclusions that standard setting not be required, or does anybody object to the conclusion that the agenda decision doesn't add to or change requirements? That is not the case. Thank you very much. Can I hand back to you, Hans?
Yes. So let's move on to the next paper. Next agenda decision. Who's going to introduce that?
Me, Hans. Thanks very much. I will now discuss agenda paper 12B. At its April meeting, the Interpretations Committee decided to finalize an agenda decision about applying the hedge accounting requirements of IFRS 9 to a proposed cash flow hedging relationship, that the objective is to hedge variability in cash flows due to real interest rates. The committee considered all the feedback received on the tentative agenda decision, including additional feedback from one of the respondents that was received after publishing the staff paper. Today, we would like to ask the board whether it objects to that agenda decision. Appendix A includes a copy of the agenda decision approved by the committee. Paragraphs 7 to 12 summarize comments received on the tentative agenda decision and the committee's April discussion. The question for the board is in paragraph 13 of the paper. I now hand back to the board.
Does anybody have a question?
Tadeu.
Thank you, Hans. Thank you, Matthias. I do not, again, object to the committee's decision conclusion. I just like to draw attention to the fact that in countries with high or hyperinflation, it is almost impossible to work with fixed interest rate, especially for long-term transactions. And the concept of real interest rate is more important, I believe, than in countries with lower inflation rates. And in this case, again, as I said, I do not object to the agenda decision. I just think that this is an area where the fact pattern may make a big difference. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tadeu. I see no other questions. Can we decide that it should not be added to the work plan and that it does not add or change requirements in IFRS standards?
Nobody objects to the decision. Objects. That's what we want. Does anybody object to the agenda decision? I hope you don't, Hans. You don't object to the agenda decision, do you?
No, of course not.
No. No, we're all good. Thank you.
All right. We can move on to the next item on the agenda, lease liability in a sale and leaseback. Dennis?
Yes. So thanks, Hans. Thanks, everybody. I'll therefore suggest we move on to agenda papers 12C to E. These papers summarize on a feedback on the board's exposure draft to lease liability in a sale and leaseback, which proposed to amend IFRS 16. The comment period ended on 29 March and the board received 87 comment letters. Agenda paper 12C provides some background information and provides an overview of the feedback. As noted in paragraph 2, we are not asking the board to make any decisions at this meeting. However, to help us develop papers for future board meetings, we will ask the board members for their initial thoughts on the feedback and to comment on any feedback that was maybe unclear or provides new information or that you deem needs further research. I propose we structure today's discussion in two parts. I will first introduce Agenda Paper 12D and then ask the board for any questions or comments on that paper. Then Stefano will introduce Agenda Paper 12E and ask the board for any questions and comments on that paper. All right, I will now introduce Agenda Paper 12D. Paragraphs 3 to 5 in the paper contrast the existing measurement requirements for lease liabilities and lease back liabilities in IFRS 16. In particular, the initial measurement of a lease back liability in a sale and lease back transaction is derived from how the right of use asset and any gain or loss on the transaction is measured. So the measurement of this lease back liability typically reflects the value of the right of use the seller lessee retains. And this means that for a sale and leaseback transaction that includes variable lease payments, the initial measurement would typically reflect the expected lease payments at market rates, including expected variable lease payments, not included in the measurement of other lease liabilities. Paragraph 6 to 8 of the paper then summarized the relevant proposals in the exposure draft. The exposure draft proposed requiring seller lessees to determine the proportion of the assets sold that relates to the right of use retained by comparing the present value of expected lease payments to the fair value of the asset sold. It also specifies the payments that then comprise the expected lease payments. So expected lease payments would include expected variable lease payments regardless of whether they depend on an index or a rate. You will note from the paper that while most respondents agree with the need to amend IFRS 16 to address this matter, almost all respondents comment on the differing treatment of variable lease payments when measuring leaseback liabilities compared to other lease liabilities. Many respondents say including such payments in leaseback liabilities raises practical and conceptual challenges. Respondents did suggest possible ways forward. Those are discussed in paragraphs 24 to 39 of the paper, and Appendix A illustrates two of the main alternative solutions suggested by respondents. I can say from our read of the comment letters, we have some questions for respondents, in particular to understand better their comments on practical challenges. And also to better understand some of the alternative solutions suggested, I think both at initial recognition and measurement, but then also subsequently. I will now ask the board for their questions and comments on the feedback summarized in Agenda Paper 12D. I guess this will really help to ensure that when we go back to respondents for further information and analyze the comments that we obtain and present all the information that you need to decide on the best way forward. Thanks, Hans.
Sue.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the analysis of this issue. Tricky to know what the next steps are. I was lucky enough to be involved in some of the outreach and to hear some of the comments firsthand, which was helpful. I wonder whether a little bit of the reaction from some, certainly not from all, but from some, is a bit of a concern or a suspicion that the proposals in the exposure draft are a sign that as sort of step two at some point, as soon as they can, the board wants to move to a model where all variable lease payments get measured and included in lease liability measurements. And so I was certainly asked that question directly at some outreach. You know, should we be concerned that this is the board sort of showing its hand on its next step? And I certainly said from my perspective, I didn't feel that was the case at all, but I do wonder if in a few cases that was an underlying concern that was sort of having an effect on people's responses, if I can put it that way. Some of the concerns on the operational aspects of it, certainly we need to look hard at that, obviously. I think we tried to be careful with that by not requiring remeasurement all of the time. I still think that sale and leasebacks happen often enough that we should care about the accounting for them, but I'm not sure such structured sale and leaseback transactions happen all the time nor multiple ones for one reporting entity. So I think maybe we need to keep it in perspective. In my experience in my past, I did a lot of sale and leaseback transactions. They were highly structured transactions that people spent hours on in terms of working out the economics, the mechanics, everything about them. They weren't ones where people wouldn't have thought really hard about what they thought the future payments were going to be, particularly if they had this sort of variability. So I suspect people probably do have the information, but we do need to look carefully at that. The thing that I found most interesting, both in the letters that we got and in the discussions, and I think your appendices are fantastic in terms of drawing out this issue, is the sort of consequences of some of the suggestions that have come back in response. And I was really pleased I got involved in outreach, because when I first started reading the letters, my first reaction was to say, to think that this deferral idea was a really sort of natural, simple way, in a sense, of trying to square the circle by sort of saying, okay, it's not really a lease liability because it wouldn't be captured in a normal lease liability, so let's call it deferred income. And on day one, that sort of seems quite innocuous and quite a neat way of making sure we don't muddy the idea of what a lease liability is. But the devil's in the detail, and the devil's in the day two accounting. And what the example that you've got in the appendix shows really neatly is that the effect of that is that for these leases where they've got these variable lease payments, if we've understood correctly what the idea is that some people have, it's resulting in the expected lease payments coming into P&L as a deferred income amount, which doesn't look like deferred income to me. And so you get a very odd day two accounting, even though in the first blush, the idea of the deferred amount seems like a nice way of sort of getting away from muddying the idea of a lease liability. So it means that I can, you know, the second approach that's in the appendix is far neater in terms of the sort of subsequent accounting and the ideas, and it also results in you getting an amount coming through P&L, which, you know, the deferral is really the amount of the gain that you weren't able to recognise on initial recognition. So it's sort of much nicer conceptually, but obviously it's much further away from our starting position, and it involves you thinking quite differently about the right of use asset at inception. So it's a big, big change from what was proposed. But I guess that was a very long way of saying that the deferral idea that many people seem to like, I think is very hard for me to see it working because of the effect on the income statement over time.
Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. And thank staff for the summary of the feedback. I think that the lease and the sale in leaseback are different transactions. And I, at the time that I was discussing this in the board, I made this a kind of analogy to the case of the intangibles. The same intangible may be in the balance sheet or not, depending on whether it was acquired, for example, in a business combination or not. It doesn't mean that there is a problem with the accounting. But I really think that we got a very good feedback from the stakeholders, some possible alternatives to assess, make some clarifications if this is the case. And again, the staff summary is very helpful to allow us to make this assessment. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Bruce?
Thanks very much, Hans. Look, when I first read this, I guess when I think about it, I mean, the reasons we gave in VC, was it 19, around why we felt that this was slightly different to a normal lease, I had a lot of sympathy for. So I could see that we went through the argument and we believed that. But kind of, I guess maybe what surprised me a bit is just the amount of feedback. I mean, the sheer volume of feedback we've got, kind of saying, guys, you know, IFRS 16 set out a principle, and the principle very clearly was we don't include variable lease payments. We've kind of used an exception here to say, well, we think that these potentially are significantly different that you can include it in. But I think the problem we've got, and this is where I think, I don't know if I'm in the same boat as where Sue is, where we're saying people are worried we're going to go all the way to variable. I think people have got to grips with the fact that we accepting variable payments are not necessarily part of a lease, and here we've come and said now they are. So I actually think the people from what I understood are trying more to reconcile the conceptual basis that we're now telling people you need to look at variable payments in a lease, which, as I said, was one of the big things we kind of highlighted when we did IFRS 16. So I think we just need to take that into account. I appreciate the comment around the operational issues. And I think from my point of view, I think that was brought up earlier for the staff. I would definitely think we do need to look at the find out from people a bit further as to why operationally this is difficult. I've also been involved in selling leaseback transactions. And I guess the one thing that surprised me was, as Sue pointed out, these are things where the information is available. I mean, very seldom were these completely, they were arm's length, but were so kind of separate parties that all the information wasn't available. So I would just encourage your staff to I think, unpack that just a bit more so we can understand what exactly are the issues on that. Just interesting, when I looked at the approaches, and thanks very much to the staff for those, I've always said I love worked examples, it helps me understand it. I kind of preferred the approach in A personally. I mean, I think that if I took the approach in A, the one that you looked at in the appendix, the first one, I felt to me that was just maybe a little bit more consistent with what we had when I was reconciling it to kind of the paragraph 100 stuff from what we looked at in an IFRS 16. So to me, the approach was probably a bit better. Well, to me, kind of reconciled a bit more to what we had. But I guess, yeah, we just need to unpack these a bit more. Thanks, Hans.
Thank you, Bruce. Nick.
Thanks, Hans. So for me, our work here and our consultation has raised some broader questions, particularly in terms of comparability. And secondly, just stepping back and thinking, as a user, what does this deferred gain that's spread over a number of years actually mean? What information does that convey to me? And I guess I'm struggling to get my head around that. It feels like the information value is quite low. I worry about whereas a big gain is very obvious in terms of the initial gain on the sale and leaseback, smaller gains spread over a number of years tend to disappear. So I have been drawn, at least in terms of exploring, to what's set out in paragraph 39A of paper 12D, which I think has at least some merit in terms of thinking about. I wouldn't say I'm firmly behind this, but I'd like to put some further thought behind this in terms of this offering some simplicity and potentially a more transparent approach. And that suggests measuring the right of use asset in a leaseback transaction in a consistently with the way that other right of use assets and lease liabilities would be measured, and then taking all the gain immediately up front. And I guess on that basis, that then takes us beyond the scope of what we've been discussing now in terms of a potential agenda decision and or a narrow scope amendment, I guess, where we are. And it seems to me then this would put us into more into the territory of the post-implementation review of IFRS 16. But I think there is certainly merit in thinking more broadly, and particularly what information is actually being conveyed to users here. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Mary?
I'll start with saying something. I had to remind myself of one of the, what I think was a critical point in the related Interpretation Committee agenda decision, which is that the original submission had said, isn't there a conflict in IFRS 16 between the requirement for how you apply the calculation of the gain or loss on a sale leaseback transaction with the requirement for how you measure a right of use asset. And I think what a piece of context that's helpful to remember is the committee's observation about why that was not a conflict in the standard, because the specific guidance on sale and leaseback overrode the part of IFRS 16 that people were citing as a potential conflict. And so, you know, if we're looking at this as a narrow scope amendment in the, you know, in filling a gap in IFRS 16, then I think we have to remember what the basic parameters are. And then the second thing I wanted to, so some of the comments that are recapped in this paper are to me implicitly going back and trying to open that issue again. And I think opening that issue would be a much, you know, bigger project than we had planned. Now, the second thing I wanted to say in terms of 12D, I'm going to pile on to the thanks that you have already had from several board members for including the worked example, because I think, like Sue, you know, I read some of the arguments about a deferral approach again and was beginning to go down that path and say maybe that works. And it's only really to me when I get to the worked examples that I see the mechanics telling me what's going on. And Hans, I'm going to lower the tone of the meeting by talking about debits and credits. If you look at in paper 12D, paragraph A7, one of the things that A7 shows, if you look at approach A, the amount of deferred income that would be recognized is 270. Well, 270 is more than the gain that the entity is precluded from recognizing because it's a sale leaseback. If you look down in the calculations, the piece that is kind of kicked out, if I've done my math right, is 150 is the amount of gain that the entity could not recognize because it, you know, was the portion of the right of use retained. The reason approach A has 270 shown as deferred income is because they're also capitalizing the cost of the right of use asset. And so that this means that this entity will report a higher gain from the transaction than it actually recognized. So for me, that makes approach A dead in the water. Approach B, sorry, I should have said 120 rather than 150. Approach B does limit the amount of deferred gain to the amount that the entity actually was precluded from recognizing on day one. So it has, I think, an advantage over approach A in that sense. But it does then conflict with the basic guidance that the interpretation committee confirmed about the measurement for a sale leaseback of the right of use asset. So I see tension, and I think that may be what Sue was referring to with approach B being a bigger, maybe not in terms of the number of words, but a bigger conceptual step than we had anticipated when we were doing that, when we proposed the narrow scope amendment. So in terms of 12D, I think those are the two comments, observations I wanted to raise about, you know, the degree of enthusiasm or not for some of the alternatives proposed. And want to encourage you to remember to put it in the context of some of the things that IFRS 16 sets out and that we set out going into this project. And I think that includes not reconsidering fundamentally whether you recognize all or only part of the gain on a sale leaseback as an example. So thanks for this paper. Well done.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. I think also this is a very good summary. A lot of further information, really helpful for us to think about this issue deeply. Just a couple of thoughts. First is that when I look at this paper, it seems that different stakeholders raise different concerns. For example, some stakeholders there said we needed to do something to address this issue. Others say that it is not so widespread, so it's maybe it's needed to wait until, you know, post implementation review of these standards or other agenda consultation related to project, for example, contingency and variable consideration, something like that. So I think first thing is that maybe we need a little bit of further information for us to decide what kind of direction we are going to do, whether we need to do something or do nothing, and based on the further information, for example, whether it is widespread. And I think it will be helpful for board and helpful for the stakeholders why we decided to do something, if we decided to do something. Secondly, if we are going to do something, previously I think one of the logic we have is about the measurement uncertainty. We think that for for seller and the lessee, normally they have more information available for them. So that means the measurement uncertainty will not be a big problem for them. But some feedback we received seemed that there are some problems. So I think we need to double check. If it will not be a problem, I think we can still move forward. If for a seller and the lessees, they have some problem, what kind of problem? Why there are no information available for them? Because they decided to do this kind of transaction arrangement. Normally they have some information in mind, you know, to sell and lease back and to arrange what kind of expected lease they needed to pay or something in future, something like that. So I think this kind of information also very, very important for us to decide. The third is about alternative approach A and B. I will not go to those detailed examples. I think those examples very, very helpful for us to look at what kind of alternative approach we can explore. But when I look at those examples and approaches, I think about the conceptual basis. What's the meaning of those deferred income liability? What's the nature of the deferred income liability? If we do require company to provide that information, whether users really can understand, for example, what's the distinction between this liability and the lease liability? Because kind of approach, I understand that it's based on, you know, applying existing lease liability requirement and also use of rights requirements of IS 16 first. So that means we do not necessarily to change the requirement and then bring the residual balance as a so-called deferred income liability. So my question, what's the meaning of this, you know, this residual balance? You know, what's the nature of this balance and what kind of information we are going to provide to the users, particularly as the initial recognition seems okay, a little bit okay. If we look at a subsequent measurement, it's really based on the based on example, we look at that we are trying to amortize that deferred balance based on the based on the passage of time. That's a straight line approach. I'm not sure this kind of information really useful or whether really reflect the economics of the transaction. Why I said whether it should be for those deferred income, that means the nature, maybe that balance should be the income. So when those incomes should be recognized into the profit loss, whether it should be based on the time or should be based on the performance fulfilled by the seller and the lessee. So I think the criteria, the recognition of those profit and loss should be very clear, you know. So, but the initial recognition and the subsequent measurement, I think they should have consistent conceptual basis, and then it will help us to look at both approaches. Otherwise, maybe we should think about, maybe we need to make change, what kind of lease liability we should, you know, we should ask those seller and lessees to present rather than to develop another kind of liabilities.
Thank you, Jen Chao. Françoise? Françoise, you're muted.
Sorry for that. And so I was saying thank you, and thank you to the team for the detailed feedback. And I think the constituents, in fact, have enriched the analysis that we all had on this issue. I have a few points that I would like to make. The first one is, in fact, in response to Mary. I don't think there is anywhere in IFRS 16 that we can read that the sale and lease back exception is an override of the basic principles that IFRS 16 has, including the fact that variable payments based on performance do not belong to these payments. And I think some of us have already alluded back to measurement uncertainty, but one of the main arguments against the recognition of these variable payments as liabilities was that they didn't convey useful information to users. And in the feedback we received, that is repeated again. So I think that there is a conflict between within IFRS 16 and that the ISBET at point in time has to resolve that conflict in one way or another. The next point I wanted to make is that when I read my alternative view, I mean, I didn't go the route of deferred income, and it, because I guess I've come to the idea that this kind of deferrals does not really bring useful information. At the same time, what we were trying to do was to bring a possible answer to an issue not dealt with in IFRS 16, and without, and I think that was a strong premise that the staff had put to us, which was not changing IFRS 16 or making the least change possible, I think was part of the objective, and it was a good objective. So when I read what constituents tell us and the default income approaches that are brought to us, I'm not going to read them through what information they bring for the reason I've just given. I think I look at them as the potential they have of being a short-term solution consistent with the overall objective of not changing or changing IFRS 16 the least. And that's the way I look at them. And when I look at A, I think A is, and we should not be ungrateful to constituents who bring this approach A to us, trying to be consistent with the agenda decision issued by the IFRS Interpretation Committee. So that they try to accommodate what has already been issued that should not have been issued. So they're acting like friends. So now when we say, well, I mean, what they bring and what they propose doesn't make sense, I think we are ungrateful to them. Approach B to me is if we go a default income route, which is, as I said, a possibility for a short-term solution, approach B as the big drawback of being in contradiction with the agenda decision, it disregards the why IFRS 16, and that's a supplementary disadvantage, disregard the why IFRS 16 goes to making sure that, because that's really, and we should not forget that either, that the main objective of the exception for sale and leaseback transaction was not to recognize a gain on part of an asset that is still available to the entity. That's the main objective. So approach B remains consistent with that objective. So that would be my two comments on A and B. And on my third point is about this idea that we could wait and wait for the part income to review and decide that it's not the right time to do anything, to let things go. I mean, not do anything further. But if we do that, I think we have to ask the Interpretation Committee to withdraw the agenda decision, so that indeed the issue at this stage would remain untouched.
Rika.
Thank you, Hans. So thank you for staff about preparing an excellent paper. First of all, about the operational challenge, I think high-level uncertainty involves structured sales and leaseback transaction that is unavoidable in practice. But I think the high-level uncertainty also exists in the other transaction when the entity has to account for complicated structured uncertainty involve uncertain variable consideration under IFRS 15. So I think how this high-level uncertainty is different from the other transaction exists when the entity account for other transaction in accordance with IFRS 15 or other standards. So I just wondering that point, I would like to see more. And another thing about conceptual challenges, considering the past IC discussion, I just wondering why the feedback doesn't consider those point inconsistent with what we've had in the past. And another thing, so I really interested in the what Nick mentioned about what compatibility of the information is really necessary for the user to analyze about the sales and leaseback transaction. And regarding two approach about the deferred income, I really want to understand the nature of this deferred income in connection with this sales leaseback transaction. I have a struggle with how we can consider this from the accounting perspective. Thank you very much.
Okay, and then finally, Tom.
Just a couple of comments that I want to highlight. And I think I would like to have a better understanding ultimately, but one of the things I'd raise is just how common are sale and leaseback with variable payments? It strikes me as a bit of a strange transaction for somebody to want to enter into, but and the second one is I do see a big tension between paragraph 100A and I note some of the comments pointed out that 100A simply tells you what to do with the asset. It's silent about the liability. And I think, as Francois pointed out, it's attached to not wanting to recognize a gain on a retained asset. But against that, there are a lot of people written in and said they'd like consistent treatment of leases and they would like leases to be accounted for consistently over time. I think whatever solution gets chosen needs to reconcile, to me, somewhat competing messages between those two things, and I'm not fully comfortable that we've done that yet. And the last one is, with respect to uncertainty, I agree with the people who wrote in and said that they did not think it reasonable that there would be a significant difference in the uncertainty attached to a sale and leaseback versus a regular lease. People do all kinds of due diligence when they sign a lease. The fact that it's this particular type of lease, I don't think they cut out the uncertainty in a markedly greater way than if somebody builds a machine and leases it directly to a company to operate it. So if that's a presumption that there's markedly less uncertainty, I don't think it's actually a legitimate one.
anyway, that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Would the staff like to make any more comments, or do you have enough feedback to go on? Yes? Okay. Thank you very much. Then we can continue with the next point, which is the subsidiaries that are SMEs.
Sorry, Hans, I think we have a couple more papers just to finish. We just want to cover off 12E and then the IFRIC update, if that's okay.
Oh, sorry about that. Yes.
Thank you. So, Stefano, do you want to summarize 12E?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Javed. Moving on to agenda paper 12E. Agenda paper 12E summarizes the feedback on the exposure draft. I will just highlight a few matters. Firstly, as set out in paragraph 7, a few respondents asked for clarity about how to determine expected lease payments as defined in the exposure draft. Secondly, as set out in paragraphs 9 to 10, some respondents expressed concern that the seller lessee would not remeasure the lease back liability to reflect a change in future variable lease payments other than for changes in the lease term or lease modifications. Lastly, paragraphs 16 to 20 summarize respondents' comments on the transition requirements. As noted in those paragraphs, a few respondents disagree with the proposed transition requirements and make alternative suggestions. I will now ask the board for their questions or comments on the feedback summarized in agenda paper 12E.
Okay, I see Mary wants to ask a question, make a comment.
Some feedback, and again, thanks for another good paper, and I think helpful to have broken it up by segregating these other issues. And I wanted to comment on several of the things that you covered in paragraph 7, Stefano. The first one, the suggestion that we provide guidance on the interaction of expected with reasonably certain to exercise. I'm assuming that we believe the general guidance in IFRS 16 on determining the expected lease term applies. And then once you have concluded what your expected lease term is, you would then be using expected payments for that already determined. So I think the interaction is clear and we don't have to provide any other guidance about that. And similarly for the suggestion about looking at the interaction with IS 21 and foreign exchange, I'm assuming it's kind of the normal interaction with IS 21 for remeasuring foreign currency liabilities. So, I think that it commenting about that in the basis is the reason for why we would not address those makes sense. I guess in terms of transition, and in particular the request for additional relief for first-time adopters, Stefano, are we covering that section as well, all in one go? Yeah, I'm struggling a bit with understanding why the relief that's in IFRS 1 now that would apply to first-time adopters doesn't achieve most, if not all, of what was set out as desirable. But again, maybe that is some confusion in the marketplace in terms of thinking about the interaction of existing requirements that may sit in IFRS 1 with requirements in the standard. And again, just staff analysis on that works through how we think things work. And if that's a reason why we don't need to do standard setting, it could maybe help on that point, but I'm not sure. So thanks for that.
Okay, Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans. Stefano, thank you very much for bringing this paper. In paragraph 15, is very short comment. Paragraph 15, you mentioned that few respondents suggested updating the proposed illustrative example. And I'm just trying to understand why they are asking this. And actually, we have more of this kind of suggestion all over the feedback. Although I agree that most of the suggestions actually would help to understand. In the end of the day, it increases the risk of unintended, let's say, excess ruling. the kind of moving to from principle towards rules, I believe we should, as for any other standard, get the right balance between what we have in the text of the standard and what we have in the illustrative example. And I would be very careful in considering the suggestions to add or make the example more elaborated. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. I don't see any other comments. Does that mean we can move on to the IFRIC update, Joeit?
Yes, I'll move on to IFRIC update and Agenda Paper 12F. Thank you, Han. So just on Agenda Paper 12F very briefly, it summarizes the committee's April meeting. And at that meeting, the committee decided to finalize two agenda decisions. We've just discussed those, so I won't mention anything further on them. In addition to those two, the committee also considered feedback on a tentative agenda decision regarding how to apply the recent amendments to IS1 on classification of debt as current or non-current to particular fact patterns. The committee confirmed its technical analysis and conclusions, but nonetheless, before finalizing the agenda decision, it decided to report to the board the comments it received on the outcomes and potential consequences of applying these amendments. We do plan to bring a paper to a future board meeting discussing this in more detail. So I will just stop here and ask if you have any questions on anything included in the April IFRIC update.
Are there any questions? That is not the case.